Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to Late Night Live. I've just flown back from Brisbane, where I spent some hours today mumbling away at a captive audience attending a conference on multiculturalism. What astonished me, these were people that actually work in various ethnic organisations or government bodies, and a remarkable number of them were listeners. So I had a lovely time. Thanks for inviting me. Shapiro, our whistleblower from Washington, is not on the programme tonight. That's because we've pushed Bruce to tomorrow to make more room for two extraordinary stories. One of them is about an authentic whistleblower, fascinating fella, technically bipolar. He wore a wire for the FBI, blew the lid on an immense Fortune 500 company scandal, and instead of being carried shoulder-high through cheering crowds, he spent 9 years in the slammer. He will be on the program, the whistleblower himself, and also the author who's written a remarkable book about him, which I understand is about to re-emerge as a whopping feature film. Imagine Erin Brockenridge on steroids. But first, a story which really hasn't had anything like the coverage in Australia it deserves, and it's gobsmacking in its scale. This is a blockbuster story. Let me... It's caused such a kerfuffle in the UK over the last few weeks, and it has all the elements of the greatest of dramas. There's an international trading company, the dumping of toxic waste in a third world country, deaths, illnesses, allegations, a court case settled out of court, a hidden report, not only an injunction on one of Britain's leading newspapers, but a super injunction, a sort of an injunction on the injunction, and an attempt to restrict reporting on Parliament, and another to stifle parliamentary debate itself. Heavens above. Yet all the drama ended when it was revealed what was going on via that new medium that I don't begin to understand, Twitter. Now, to fill us in on all of the above, I'm joined by The Guardian's investigation executive editor, David Lee, The Guardian being the newspaper directly involved in this intrigue. David doubles as the Anthony Sampson Professor of Reporting at City University, London. And we also welcome to the program Eric Berendt, the Goodman Professor of Media Law at the University College, London. Eric's lectured at unis around the planet and has also advised the British government on several aspects of media law. Gentlemen, before we start teasing out the story, it is a sort of a house rule that I always ask my guests to name or to explain the identity of the person for whom their chair is named. So, Eric, tell us about Goodman.
Well, Arnold Goodman was a very well-known solicitor who established a leading law firm in London, Goodman Derrick. He'd actually been a student at University College London and had taught a little bit in the 1930s, I think. Anyhow, he became an advisor to both Harold Wilson and Ted Heath in the 1960s and 1970s, and some friends of his, when he retired, decided to establish a chair in media law in his honour, and I'm the proud holder of the first holder of that chair, which was endowed in 1990.
Forgive the banal pun, but he's obviously a good man to be honoured in this
way.
He was
regarded in many ways as an almost saintly man, and I think he did have
people
some
say
of those aspects.
People say the same of you, Eric. Now, David, tell the listener, your Antipodean listener, about Anthony Sampson.
Anthony Sampson was one of the great British journalists of the 20th century. He wrote a series of books, the first of which was called The Anatomy of Britain, back in the 1960s, which really took to pieces the way the country worked and exposed for the first time this sort of establishment network of archbishops and permanent secretaries and knights of the realm, that an old Etonians that really ran the place. His career culminated with a landmark biography of Nelson Mandela, who was one of his heroes. And he wrote a whole string of books, really, taking the world to pieces.
Well, David, you should be very proud to be working in his name or under his saintly auspices. Now, David, you're going to tell the foundations of this story while Eric sits patiently waiting to join us a little later. First of all, tell us about the company that's involved.
This is a story about big business and the oil trade, really. And the oil trade is enormous. It's $600 billion a year. And although we don't think very much about it, I mean, as we speak, there are enormous sort of super tankers churning up and down the globe with huge cargoes of thousands of tons of oil. This story started because Trafigura is one of the big independent oil traders. There's about three of them, Vitol, Glencore, and Trafigura. And it's a kind of shadowy organization. It operates very much offshore, but in fact it has an enormous turnover, something like $70 billion a year. These are people.
I'm sorry, David, you said $70 billion?
$70 billion US dollars a year. Yeah, it's big.
Now, what are their sins of omission and commission that start the saga rolling?
Well, it turns out that they had a little scheme for making a lot more money, which involved buying several cargoes of contaminated oil very cheap from a Mexican state oil refinery. And then they were going to put it through a primitive cleaning up process, which involved mixing it with caustic soda. This was going to get the contaminating sulfur out of it, and it was going to render the stuff more or less saleable to African countries who aren't too choosy. The problem they had was that this process left a huge pile of toxic waste, all kind of weird sulfurous compounds that can generate hydrogen sulfide, which is a killer gas. So they had hundreds of tons of a stinking black mass of highly toxic waste that it wasn't allowed to dump anywhere in Europe. What it did, to cut the story short, was it went and dumped it in one of the poorest countries in West Africa, the Ivory Coast. It paid a local contractor to take it away, who proceeded to put it on a landfill. Thousands and thousands of people from Abidjan, the capital of the Ivory Coast, then got sick, and they all turned up besieging the hospitals, retching and coughing. And in the end, 30,000 of them sued the company, one of the biggest lawsuits in history, for damages because they'd been poisoned.
Wow. We're off to a great start. Now, let me just ask you a question which must have come up down the track. The illnesses were authentic illnesses. There wasn't a sort of a dimension of panic on top of a minor problem.
There was certainly possibly an element of mass hysteria, as you can imagine, if everybody's falling sick around you and you don't know what's going on and you don't know why. I think people did panic a whole lot. But at the end of the day, it was agreed that this stuff did make people sick. The oil company ended up having an argument with the other side's lawyers about just how sick it had made them.
Now, David, there's a connection, too, with a storage facility in Norway that exploded due to the nasty stuff inside it.
Oh, sure, this toxic waste, they touted it all around the world trying to get rid of it. It's a bizarre story. First of all, they went to an oil terminal in Tunisia off the coast of North Africa, and they paid the people there to store the stuff and process it. It caused such vile smells that people got sick there and protested, and they were thrown out of Tunisia. Then they tried to do their chemical process at sea and dump the waste in Africa. When all that went horribly wrong with these thousands of people getting sick, they took themselves off to Norway and they persuaded the owner of a tank farm there to take some of the waste and try and process it. Unfortunately, it blew up. And
I'm sorry to laugh. This is so serious. But God, what a saga.
Well, they sort of had bad luck, these people. Everything they tried turned to a disaster.
Okay, now tell us about the secret report, the scientific report that the company commissioned a month after the material was dumped on the hapless Ivory Coast.
Yeah, this is a story that really, its ramifications go all over the world. This was dumped. Everybody in Abidjan rushed to hospital. There was a terrible situation. Trafigura commissioned some scientific experts of their own to say, what have we done? They wrote a report. It was called the Minton Report. John Minton was the author, from some English scientific consultants. And they said, well, actually what you've done is something really terrible, because this stuff is full of potentially hazardous and toxic compounds, some of which are capable of killing people, and also, you know, causing quite serious skin injuries and burns and so on. And they said it was all would have been completely illegal to dump this anywhere in Europe. And basically, you know, boy, what have you done?
Dear, oh dear. Now, was the messenger blamed for the message?
What they did with the report, Trafigura, when they got it, was I think they went a bit white and they locked it in a safe.
It's a wonder the safe didn't explode.
Yeah. Anyway, they didn't tell anybody about this report.
Okay. Now, I understand that Minton said there was perhaps a way to deal with this crap called wet air oxidation, but that wasn't attempted.
Yeah, there were a couple of really expensive and difficult ways of getting rid of this waste. One was wet air oxidation, as it's called. Another would have been incineration in a special furnace with a high chimney and filters and all that. But the problem with those things is they would have been extremely expensive, and Trafigura's huge profit, which they've seen, would have evaporated. So they didn't want to do that.
Now, David, what is one of the things that now astonishes is that the company manages to conceal its existence. The contents were not disclosed to the other side when lawyers for the 30,000 claimants from the Ivory Coast brought a huge compensation suit. I would have thought that was illegal.
Well, apparently you're allowed to do this. I don't know that much about lawyers, but it turns out that you're allowed to commission expert reports, and if you don't like them, you're allowed to sit on them and not tell the other side about them, at any rate in British litigation. So that's what happened. Nobody knew about this report.
Now, David, I want you to make a confession to us now. Remember that no one in the UK is listening. How did you get a copy of the Minton Report?
Well, wild horses wouldn't drag it from me, as you know very well. I'm a journalist, and journalists die rather than betray their sources.
Well, can you answer this? Did fraternal organisations have it? Did others in what we used to call Fleet Street have possession of the same report?
Well, there is a story at the back of this, and the story is every time media all across the world try to write about Trafigura and this toxic waste dumping and what have they done, Trafigura hired its lawyers and its PR men to jump on them all over the world. And they jumped on them not only in Britain, where they sued the BBC as well as threatened us, but they also had a go at papers in the Netherlands and at the state broadcasting company in Norway. So anywhere the story popped up, they sent lawyers to harass people.
This is the Carter Ruck organisation, I understand.
Correct.
Now, when Carter Ruck died, I can't find the note here, but someone made the wonderful observation that he did for freedom of the press what the Boston Strangler did for door-to-door salesmen.
Yeah, that's what somebody wrote in the obituary of the founder of the firm, Peter Carter Ruck.
Okay. Now, I understand, however, that various organisations with whom I've had associations, including Greenpeace and the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, had it.
Because Trafigura set their lawyers onto everybody, out of sheer self-defense, all the media organizations and the groups like Greenpeace who've been campaigning as well, we all got together and we said we've got to protect ourselves against the Carter Rucks of this world. So we started to share information, and that was really how the Minton Report emerged. And it emerged from somewhere, and we all shared it out between us.
David, is it an entire coincidence? I'm very naive about these things, that at the time you acquired the report, the company settled out of court and confidentially that class action?
Well, it's certainly true that when we got hold of this documentation, shortly afterwards, the company rapidly announced that it was going to settle the case, and it offered to pay out £30 million UK pounds in compensation to all these people. That would have been about £1,000 each for the 30,000 injured people, provided the whole settlement was kept confidential.
Now, before I bring that paragon of patient Eric into the discussion, another question. When the company knew you had a copy of the report, they issued The Guardian, not just with an injunction, well, we're all familiar more or less with that, but a super injunction. I've never heard of a super injunction. What the hell is it?
Well, I'd never heard of one, and I said to my lawyer in court, what's all this? I didn't know this kind of thing happened. And she said, how would you know? Because it's all kept secret. I was issued with an injunction which said I wasn't allowed to tell anybody what was in the Minton report, and nor were any other newspapers in Britain. But then on top of that, I was issued with a super injunction which said, and you're not allowed to tell anybody that you've been served with this injunction.
Ladies and gentlemen, this extraordinary story is just beginning. You won't believe where it's heading. This is Late Night Live, abc.net.au/rn. And we're talking about a case where an international company tried to prevent the reporting and a debate in Parliament in the UK. And my guests are The Guardian's Investigations Executive Editor, David Lee, and now, at long last, Professor of Media Law, Eric Berendt. Eric, would you judge, in your judgment, did the judge judge rightly in granting the super injunction?
Well, no. I'm slightly surprised that he granted a non-super injunction, because this report, the Guardian story, was clearly of immense public interest, and I'm not sure, I haven't read the judge's judgment, I don't know whether it's been published yet, I'm not sure whether he fully considered the arguments which might have been made by the Guardian to allow it to publish the story. So,
but Eric, doesn't it go against your Human Rights Act and freedom of speech and that act that allows free reporting on Parliament?
Yeah, well, you're as it were, bringing together two or three different points. I mean, one is, of course, the Parliamentary Papers Act and freedom of speech in Parliament and well-recognised case law has established that you can't stop newspapers or other branches of the media publishing what is discussed in Parliament. And here the Guardian was, there was an attempt to stop the Guardian publishing a parliamentary question. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is under our Human Rights Act, which incorporates the right to freedom of expression and press freedom under the European Convention. Courts, before they grant an injunction, must pay particular regard to the public interest in freedom of expression. And if a story is arguably of real public interest, this should be considered by the court, by the judge, before granting any sort of injunction, whether interim or permanent.
Now, Eric, this super injunction is an astonishing prospect as sort of coming across the Loch Ness Monster in Hyde Park. Can you imagine a situation where a super injunction might be warranted, you know, in the same way that perhaps a D-notice might be applied in the case of national security?
I find it very difficult to contemplate such circumstances. I mean, I do think there are some circumstances in which it's legitimate to stop the media publishing a story which might, the publication of which might imperil, say, national security or put some individual's life in danger. But to stop publication of the story that an injunction has been granted in those terms seems to me to be completely nonsense. Indeed, arguably, it's counterproductive because it stops other people knowing what the terms of the injunction are, and that has repercussions.
Now, coming back to you, David, and you're obviously a very dangerous fellow who's got to be kept under control. Let's talk about how the injunction prevented you from reporting on what was happening in Parliament. An MP had tabled a forthcoming question that you were being legally prevented from reporting on. What was the question?
Well, the question was, what does the government think about this injunction preventing publication of the Minton report? Which was, gave the game away, you know?
And so, bang, you cop that as well.
Well, this was an interesting mixture of the old and the new about how it got the whole thing got bust open, because the old part of it was an MP using British parliamentary privilege was able to say things, and ultimately we were able to report them, that no one else was allowed to. That was the old part. But the new part was, as soon as we were prevented from reporting Parliament, our editor, Alan Rusbridger, put out a tweet on Twitter. And he said, hey, guess what? We've been prevented from reporting a parliamentary question by this firm of Carter Ruck. And the next thing was, they all went wild. All these Twitterers in the Twitter sphere went berserk. And by the next morning, there were hundreds and thousands of them. They'd all looked up the parliamentary order paper, discovered what the question was. They were all telling each other what it was. And they were all putting out links to the Minton report, which had been out there on WikiLeaks all the time, only we weren't allowed to say so. And by lunchtime, the whole thing was completely blown open. And they all took a lot of credit for, they said it was Twitterers what done it.
Okay, one of the Twitterers was Stephen Fry, who retweeted the story, and I'm shocked to learn he has 830,000 followers. I'm shocked because I've never done a tweet or, in fact, been on the receiving end of one, as far as I know. Eric, in your memory, your considerable memory, has Parliament ever been gagged before in this way?
Well, I don't think Parliament was gagged. I think it was the reporting of Parliament which was gagged. It would be quite impossible to stop free speech in Parliament. So the answer is no. Parliamentary debates and questions are free, and that's covered by the 1688 or Bill of Rights Act, Article 9, and that goes back a long way, even before my time as a professor of media law.
Yeah. Okay, now David, I understand that theoretically this suppression order, this whatever we call it, does apply to other modes of publication, including Twittering or WikiLeaking, but how the hell are you going to handle it?
Well, they don't have any way of stopping it. It was pretty outrageous that these shyster lawyers should try and make out that you couldn't report Parliament. I mean, trying to overturn 200 years of history. But they can't stop things that go on the internet. WikiLeaks, for example, where it was, nobody's found a way of making them take stuff down. They have servers all over the world.
Mm. Eric, the Lord Chief Justice, yours, is reported as saying that London has the reputation of being the libel capital of the world. I'm surprised by this. I assume that honour would have to belong to a US city. But is it a...
No, not at all.
So what, tell me about London. Why does London attract libel suits?
Well, I think it's largely because of the relatively generous awards of damages which can be obtained in this country. The United States, New York, for example, is not the libel capital of the world for a very good reason, that there are very generous press privileges. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution means that the press is pretty libel-proof in the U.S.
Yeah.
But in this country, we have more claimant-friendly libel laws and quite generous awards of damages, which makes it more sensible to bring an action in England than it does in, say, France or Germany, where awards are very, very much lower.
And David, that gives me a great idea. Why don't you libel me, very generously in The Guardian? I'll sue and you and I can split the profits.
Do you know, I've often thought of that. It's a really good idea.
I love this little detail in the story, and that involves an art prize, David, that had the company's name stuck all over it. Tell me what happened to the art prize.
Well, I mean, Trafigura, they've been getting a lot of bad press about their toxic waste, as you can imagine. So what they did was they hired a firm of lobbyists called Bell Pottinger, which is founded by Sir Tim Bell, who was Mrs. Thatcher's favourite PR man. They've been going around organising little charities and things like that for Trafigura to be seen to be doing nice things for the kiddies and so on. Their latest little scheme was the Trafigura Art Prize, and they said they would award £4,000 to a promising young artist.
Not for oil paintings, presumably.
No, watercolours, probably.
Watercolours. Oh, dear. And I understand that the art prize is now not worth much money, but at least it doesn't come besmirched.
Well, when the Minton report came out, all these artists apparently said they didn't want to be associated with Trafigura, thank you very much, and they could keep their prize, so it all had to be abandoned.
Look, I've thoroughly enjoyed this terrible story, and I thank you both for your participation. The Guardian's investigation executive editor and professor of reporting at City Uni, and Eric Berendt, Goodman Professor of Media Law at University College London. Hallowed be thy names, gentlemen. Late Night Live, let's play a bit of music, and we'll meet a quite remarkable whistleblower and the author who has told us his story.